I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Maryland's senior U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski announced her retirement this morning, saying she will not run as a candidate for re-election in 2016. The 78-year-old senator has been in Congress since the 1970s. We will devote the second hour of today's show to the Mikulski announcement, and we'll have a report in the coming hour and commentary from senior news analyst Fraser Smith. Our regular monthly hour on health with Dr. John Smarr will be rescheduled. Also in the hour ahead, we'll look at the issue of politics and parole and the question before the Maryland legislature, should Maryland's governor be removed from the process? First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR. Thanks again for joining us. The big news out of Baltimore today is that Senator Barbara Mikulski, the senior senator from Maryland, has been in the U.S. Senate since 1987, in Congress since 1976, announced that she would retire when her term ends in 2017. She will not be a candidate for re-election in 2016. Because every day I want to wake up thinking about you, the little guys and gals, the watermen, automobile workers, researchers, small business owners, and families, Mikulski said. Today I want to give you 120% of my time with all of my energy focused on you and your futures, because it's always been about you, never about me. That's what it takes to be a good senator, by my expectations and by my standards. That's a quote from Barbara Mikulski explaining why she would not be running for re-election in 2016. So we're going to talk a little bit about this here in the early going of this hour and then devote the whole second hour of our show today from 1 to 2 p.m. here, the midday second hour, all about the Mikulski announcement. So you can call in at that time and share your views with us. We'll also be hearing from political Maryland blogger and commentator Barry Raskovar. Melissa Deckman from Washington College will be joining us, too, to comment on this. And Matt Crenson from Johns Hopkins University, all commenting in the second hour of our show today about the Mikulski announcement. Right now, I'd like to just spend a couple of minutes with WYPR senior news analyst Fraser Smith to get his reaction to this announcement. Fraser, good afternoon.
Hi, Dan.
Are you surprised?
Absolutely. I don't think the world is surprised. The world of Maryland politics is surprised. I mean, she had been scoping out the terrain of Maryland after the recent election, trying to decide how it would trigger into her attempt to win re-election. So I think everybody thought, you know, that she was in the game again. And I wondered if she would ever retire, frankly. Yeah. But here we are.
Yeah, I'm in the same. I took the same position you did on this. Even after talking with people who claim to know Mikulski, they weren't sure. 78 years old. You know, she had some health problems a couple of years ago, but nobody seemed convinced that she wasn't going to run for re-election. Now it's very clear. So, what do you take from this? Martin O'Malley is no longer governor of Maryland. He was the state's leading statewide Democrat behind Mikulski and the Senator Ben Cardin. So he's sitting right there, isn't he?
You mean as a potential new senator?
Yes.
Well, I guess, did she give a date for when she's leaving?
Well, let's see. She will retire when her term is up in 2017. So that means January.
It'll be up to the voters, and there will be probably, at least for the next short period, a cast of thousands will be mentioned as potential successors.
Right, but I only mentioned Martin O'Malley because until January, he was governor of Maryland, and it would seem to me to be the leading candidate to replace Mikulski.
Well, perhaps so. I think that, again, you're going to find everybody's going to have a lift. Chris Van Hollen has been somebody that sort of actually deferred to Ben Cardin some years ago when Cardin was elected. I mean, he has become an important player in the House, so that would figure into his decision about whether to do this or not. But people, I think, would put him near the top of the list. It just really is the kind of thing that you have, it's difficult to put your finger on who might want to try to do this.
Mm-hmm. And, Frazier, before I let you go here, because I'd like you to join us again in the second hour of the show as well, just a comment about Mikulski's career. You know, the first political story I covered for the Baltimore Sun was the election of Jimmy Carter in Baltimore in 1976. I was out in a precinct in East Baltimore, and Barbara Mikulski showed up campaigning, and that's the first time I met her. So I go back to 1976 with her.
Well, you know, she was known for a few things. I mean, she is definitely one of the principal women's rights advocates in politics, certainly in the Senate. She is known to people like Dan, you and me for being very good on her feet. Lots of really interesting, funny quotes, usually pointing in the direction of her political philosophy. And also being a pretty tough boss. I think on Capitol Hill, people regard her as one of the toughest. And that's just her decision about what it took to do the things that she talked about in the statement that you read, you know, to be on top of the problems of the people every day.
1976, she emerged in Baltimore as a social worker, a community activist, and then off to Congress in 1976, won the Senate seat in 1987 against Linda Chavez, who was the Republican candidate that year. We'll go over Frazier.
And prior to that, Dan, she beat some of the stars of the male side of the Democratic Party to win the nomination, and she won it with 60%. You know, her numbers over the years have been they've been landslide dimensions.
Listen, we'll talk some more about this in the second hour, okay?
Okay, Dan.
Yep, WYPR senior news analyst Frazier Smith will be joining us, as I say, in the second hour of the show. We'll have open phone lines for your comments about Senator Barbara Mikulski. Here, as promised in this hour, we're going to take a look at the politics of parole in Maryland, a movement to remove the governor from the parole process. We're going to explain this to you in this hour of the show. Maryland is one of only three states in the country in which the governor has the power to approve parole or reject parole for lifers, inmates serving life sentences. And as you'll see during this hour of the show, that is a power governors have exercised and not allowing lifers to be released from our prisons since sometime in the 1990s, I think was the last time it was done. I want to welcome onto the show Baltimore City Delegate Jill Carter, who is a sponsor of a bill that she'll describe for us in this hour of the show. Jill Carter, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hey, before we get into the politics of parole, just your reaction to the Mikulski announcement, Jill. Are you surprised by it?
Well, not surprised that it's happening, because it's been speculated for some time that she might retire, and it was speculated that she might do it in a way that the governor might be appointed. But that was all just speculation. Mm. So, and then there was another kind of foolish political thought that she would never retire. So the fact of the timing of it now is a little surprising. But, I just think that there must be some strategy to it, some method to the madness.
Well, that's why I mentioned the name Martin O'Malley there. He goes out of office as governor as time is up after two terms. And within 6 weeks of his leaving Annapolis, we get this announcement. So I'm just speculating like everybody else today.
But I think that it's going to be a mad dash. I think that, you know, more than there'll be some interest from a number of candidates, and candidates that already have raised a significant amount of money and may be postured to go for the seat.
Jill Carter, again, thank you for joining us. So let's talk about what's on your mind in Annapolis, this specific bill having to do with the parole process in Maryland and the governor. I just explained it in brief here. We have a Maryland Parole Commission that makes recommendations to the governor, and in Maryland, the governor is allowed to approve or disapprove those recommendations, correct?
Correct.
And when it comes to lifers, we have seen governors reluctant to release them, even when they are recommended for parole.
Exactly. Yes, precisely.
So your bill would just remove the governor from this process completely?
Yes, it would put it in the sole authority, within the sole authority of the parole commission to make the recommendations without having to have any weigh-in or any approval by the governor. In 2011, we passed a measure moving in this direction, which the bill was then that with the governor had 6 months to deny a decision of the parole commission concerning this population of inmates. And prior to that, the governor had not usually weighed in that matter, but as soon as we put it that, you know, unless there's a denial within 6 months, then the recommendation stands, then suddenly there were denials. And so that wasn't going far enough. And as you said, we're one of only three states in the whole country that puts it into the hands of the governor to make a decision. And the belief is that it's too political a decision to wind up having with just results for persons that deserve it because of the reaction to the concept of violent crime. And, you know, we move away politically from the concept of redemption. But it's timely because there's finally a lot of talk and consideration given to mass incarceration, to a failed prison system. And I think it's, you know, it makes common sense. It's fiscally responsible. But even more than that, it's really honesty or truth in sentencing, because we're talking about people that upon their sentencing, they were given the belief that they would be paroled one day because they were sentenced to life with the possibility of parole.
Yeah, that's where I get hung up. You committed a crime, a murder, a rape. You got a life sentence from a judge, but the judge sentenced you to life with the possibility of parole. So you go into prison, 15 years go by, 20 years go by, 25, 30 years, and I'm not saying this is the case in all cases, but best behavior, get your GED, do all the things, go through a training program that's offered in a prison someplace, do everything you're supposed to do, stay out of trouble, because there's the possibility of parole up ahead. And then you get to a parole hearing or several hearings. The Maryland Parole Commission recommends you, but a governor who has to run for re-election decides, maybe not, I'm not going to release you. Walter Lomax is joining us in the studio, Jill. Walter Lomax is executive director of the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative. Walter has been on our show before. He spent almost 40 years behind bars for a wrongful conviction. He was released from prison in 2016 and has put a lot of time and effort into helping others like himself, ex-offenders, especially those coming out of prison and those still in prison. Walter, it's nice to get you back on the show with us.
It's nice to be here, Dan.
You are one of those men. You were recommended for parole. You had the possibility of parole in your life sentence, did you not?
Exactly. When Governor Glenn Dennis made that announcement in 1995 and at the Maryland House of Correction, I was one of the people that was in the bunch of people that he actually denied parole.
His announcement there in 1995, Paris Glendening, was life means life. No more parole for lifers.
Exactly.
And had you been recommended by that time?
Yes, I had been recommended for parole at least four different occasions during my incarceration. And each time I was denied, the most final time was when Governor Glenn Dennis denied me in 1995. But I want to speak to the larger issue here, and Jill is absolutely right. This is a fiscal responsible bill here. And when the legislation was passed in 2011, after almost 15 years at that time, it's been over 20 years now.
I mean, 20 years since anyone was paroled?
Paroled.
Since a lifer was paroled?
Right, serving a parole eligible life sentence. And so we've been advocating on behalf of this issue since then. But in 2011, when the legislation was passed, the legislators then, they recognized that this was an issue that really needed to be addressed. And they really thought that by passing the 180 days to 6 months, that it would give an opportunity for some of these people to be released. And I think that they were modeling that decision based on what was going on, what was happening in California. Because when Governor Brown came into office, he took a complete opposite reversal of previous governors, and that over 80% of the people that were recommended for parole by the parole commission were actually released. And so I think that the Maryland legislators felt that, well, maybe by using this as a standard, that this may incrementally allow people to be released from parole. But shortly after the legislation became effective in 2012, the governor summarily denied all of the petitions that was before him, well over 50.
I just want to explain that for a minute with Jill's help, Jill Carter's help. So the legislature said, okay, the governor will still be involved in this process, but you have 6 months from the time somebody, 180 days from the time somebody is recommended for parole, a lifer is recommended for parole, to say up or down. And if you don't say anything, that inmate is paroled. Is that right, Jill?
Correct.
Okay. And in the case of Martin O'Malley, what year was that, 2012 or 2013, he said no to everybody except for a couple of...
2012.
He released two people.
Well, he commuted three sentences.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And ironically...
But he denied everyone else.
Yeah, at that time, we were seeking legislation to address what's called the felony murder statute and the felony murder law, and the folk who were juveniles when they were sentenced to parole-eligible life sentences. And he commuted those sentences. He addressed the issues that we had before the legislatures. He released two people who were former juveniles, and one was convicted under the felony murder statute.
Right.
But I want to be clear with this, Dan. See, at the time when this policy was implemented, there was only a few people, less than 300, that were serving parole-eligible life sentences. And at the time, it was kind of manageable. Now we have well over 2,600 people that are serving these sentences. And it's beyond the capability of any one person to manage that, specifically with the politics that's really involved
well,
in that process.
Yeah, I mean, but why do you have a parole commission?
Well, I want to make a clear
all
point
right,
there. And this is that at that time, we didn't have what we know now about people who were juveniles. And the vast number of people that we had that are juveniles that are serving parole-eligible life sentences. And we did not have the vast number of people that had been convicted under the felony murder law. We had one case in particular. Two individuals who was in the process of a robbery. The person that was being robbed wrestled with the individual that had the weapon and eventually shot and killed him. The individual that was with him who got away was eventually arrested, wound up spending almost 40 years in prison for that crime. He did not shoot anybody. He was just a part of a robbery.
That's felony murder.
Felony murder. This is egregious. It's really egregious. And then all of the information that we have now on the development of the juveniles, it is unconscionable to take a 15, 16, 17-year-old person and think that there's no redeemable qualities in this individual. Now, we are advocating that politics be removed from the process altogether, which means that allow these people that are appointed to make this decision to make this decision.
I want to go to Jill just with my question about the parole commission. I mean, we have a parole commission in Maryland who examine these cases and actually hear from the inmates and from the victims' families are often allowed to appear at these hearings. That's where the work is done. It's like to Walter's point, to think that a governor could know as much about the parole commission and decide one way or the other just doesn't seem realistic.
Well, no, it doesn't. And as it's often been said, the parole commissioners are the ones who are in the best position to know who should be recommended for release and who should not. And I also want to make it clear that just because someone is eligible for parole, such as in Walter and so many other cases that go up before the parole board numerous times, they are, just because you're eligible does not mean you will be recommended for release. It's only the category of individuals that actually has been productive and shown signs of progress, redemption, and self-improvement that are going to be recommended. Anyone who has not done so is not likely to be recommended. And with regard to the juveniles, we currently have over 300 that are serving these sentences. And, you know, the Supreme Court has said that it is unconscionable for a child to serve a life without parole sentence, which functionally that's what happens when we keep the governor with politics in the process.
Maryland Delegate Jill Carter from Baltimore City on the phone with us. Walter Lomax, in the studio with me. And I'm going to ask this question before we go to the break, and then you can give us your answer when you get back. And also, this is a question for our listeners with regard to removing the governor from the parole process in Maryland. Should an elected official be responsible, held responsible by the voters if something goes wrong? You know, if a lifer gets out and commits another crime, should an elected official bear that responsibility? Or should we take the governor out of this process, remove politics, the scent of politics, the concern about politics from the parole process? We'd like to hear from you. 410-662-8780. This is Midday, a short break. We'll come back and get an answer to that question from my guests, but we also like to hear from our listeners on this. What do you think about removing the governor from the process? Do you like having the governor involved in this because you have somebody who shares the responsibility for this this process, this system of release of inmates, who stands election? 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. 410-662-8780 is our number here. Walter Lomax is with me from the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative. He spent 40 years in prison for a wrongful conviction. He's been working with that initiative since he got out. And looking specifically at the Maryland parole process for lifers, those serving life with the possibility of parole, who have hundreds of them have been turned down by governors because in Maryland is one of only three states where the governor has that veto power to get a recommendation for a parole from the Maryland Parole Commission and still say no. Walter thinks just the governor should just be removed from that process. So my question was, to those who say, no, you need to have an elected official, someone who answers to the people, put a face on this. Responsible if something goes wrong, if a lifer gets out and commits another crime. So what do you say about to that?
Well, I would say take a look around the country and see how many governors have been convicted of crimes, and to say that, you know, just to think that just because a person has been elected that they are in the best position to make that decision. But this is really what I really want to point out, and this is that other people that the governor denied in 2012, since there was a decision, court decision, court of appeals decision in Maryland, Unger v. State.
The Unger's case, yeah.
And since 2012, when the governor denied those people, over 80 of those individuals are now free in society and doing great.
Because of that court of appeals ruling.
And ironically, 17 of those individuals were amongst the group that was denied in 2012. Now, this is not to say that everything has been easy. In fact, we had one young man who was 15 years old when he went to prison. He spent over 38 years incarcerated. He's been living in transitional housing since he's been released, and he's had difficulty maintaining employment because of health issues. So it is a challenge. It is really a struggle. But in spite of all of that, this young man continues to do good, positive things like attending our life skills program to try to rebuild his life. So for those people who say that those people are a threat to public safety, we have well over 80 that's released so far, and there are well over 100 that's still in the pipelines to be released.
Back to my question, though. You vote for a governor, you don't vote for a parole commission. I mean, I just want to know, what is your answer to that? Because I hear this from people.
The governor appoints the parole commission.
There are staggered terms. Not all governors get to appoint everybody on the parole commission.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But the parole commission have an opportunity to see these individuals over an extended period of time, 15, 20, some cases 30 years or more. They have an opportunity to really study these individuals. And for someone saying, well, the governor takes a second look, well, there are two commissioners that actually makes that initial decision. And then that decision has to go before the full board. That's the second look. And along the way, there are risk assessments that's being done. There are psychological evaluations that's being done. And these individuals, from starting from maximum security to minimum security to medium security to work release, family leave, and then actually eventually released on parole. And I want to say this. I think Judge Mott said it most eloquently in a court decision involving this life means life policy. And he said, hope and a longing for reward lie at the heart of every human endeavor. In its absence, there's no reason for anyone to do anything good. And so what has happened in the prison system in Maryland is that there has been no incentive for an individual to change behavior. And this is why we have so many problems with the young people coming into prison and seeing older people that's been there 20, 30, 40 years not going anywhere. Then there's no reason for them to change their behavior.
Thank you, Walter. We'll go back to Delegate Carter, Jill Carter, just to get her comment in response to my question about that I hear from people who say there should be a public face on parole. Someone should have to answer. An elected official should have to answer for those decisions. So what's your response to that, Jill?
Well, I would disagree because, first of all, we're talking about decisions that a judge initially made that this person would be eligible or should be eligible at some point. And so I think it actually smacks upon a violation of separation of powers when you have a decision that a judge made, and then ultimately you have an executive that summarily denies it, no matter what the person or individuals have done or tried to accomplish in order to achieve what was essentially the benefit of the bargain, the promise at sentencing time. And so that would be my answer. I think that we should follow the lead of the 47 other states that don't do this, don't have this process.
Jill, do you know Maryland parole commissioners? They're appointed by the governor, but they have what, 3-year terms? Is that right?
I believe they have staggered terms. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember looking into this last year or the year before, and the concern was, well, a governor could just appoint. He could stack his own parole commission with people who never grant parole to lifers. But I think that would be hard to do, even with a governor who serves 2 terms and the staggered terms. Jill, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, Delegate Jill Carter, sponsor of this bill to remove the governor completely from the parole process. I want to welcome onto the show now Tessa Hill Aston, president of the Baltimore NAACP, who's joining us today to talk about an issue regarding the Maryland correctional system and how we punish people in the state. Tessa, nice to have you on the show again.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. And also with us is Mark Schindler, who now is executive director of the nonprofit Justice Policy Institute, which spends a lot of time looking at policy in our state, corrections policy in Maryland. Nice to have you on the show, Mark.
Great to be here.
Yeah. And notably, your report recently on the costs of incarceration in Maryland, specifically the costs of keeping Baltimoreans behind bars, and even more specifically, offenders from a certain Baltimore neighborhood that you guys looked at. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But I wonder if you had a comment about this before we go to the phone lines. I want to hear from our listeners in a moment.
Sure.
But this on this concept of the governor involved in the parole process.
Well, absolutely. And I think what Walter and the delegate are talking about is absolutely right. I mean, we have a situation where we are trying to remove politics from the process and inject best practices based on policy and research. So it has become, and it's not working here in Maryland, overly politicized in terms of this decision. And I think, as Walter noted, with the recent Unger decision, we essentially have a case study that is showing why this is a bad way to move forward, right? And so the fact is, we know based on research that when folks are moving on in their life, they're just less likely to recidivate, right? And so we are spending an extraordinary amount.
I mean, if they're 55, 60,
that's right.
65 years old.
That's right. The likelihood of them coming out and committing crime is much, much lower. And you have a parole commission looking specifically at that and weighing that. So when we have a recommendation to release that is not taken lightly and a person has served an extended period of time, basically, as taxpayers, we're being short shrifted because we're spending extraordinary amounts of money and not getting good outcomes for it. So I think it's appropriate at this time, and what the bill does is really inject best practice and policy based on the research and removes politics from this process, and the politics just hasn't worked.
The Commonwealth of Virginia, which has no parole, has had no parole for maybe a decade now or more, has a geriatric prison somewhere down in Southern Virginia. I forget exactly what town it's in, but it's set up mainly as it's like a nursing home behind bars, because I assume older inmates cost us more.
About 5 times as much to house an older inmate because of the health costs than a younger inmate, and so you're exactly right. And we've done studies both in Virginia and Maryland, and essentially what we're doing is exactly what you just said. We're turning our prisons into very, very expensive nursing homes.
Tessa, do you have a comment about this? We're going to get to your issue in a moment here, which has to do with ex-offenders, but do you have a comment about the parole process?
Yeah, I agree that that sometimes there's too much political point in it, because I've seen where I have tried to help and assist people who were going for parole hearing and they've been rejected. And most of them were senior citizens. And I go to Jessup to visit people. We get letters every day at the NWCP office. So I do agree that it should be looked at. I do agree with the delegate and with Mr. Schindler.
Let's get some comments here from listeners. We'd like to hear from them. 410-662-8780. Terry in Westminster, your thoughts on this, please.
Hi, Dan. Hi. This is a very thought-provoking question, and I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't taken it a step further in my own mind thinking about the political ramifications of these decisions. And I think your guest today that has been incarcerated has made me see that the political process should be completely eliminated from this. And one further question is, who makes up a typical parole board?
Well, let's see. David Blumberg is the chairman. He's been the chairman of the Parole Commission quite a long time, I think. But I note here from the State of Maryland webpage that his term expires in 2013, so I assume he has to be renewed like everybody else. And the other members' names are also on here as well. I don't know their backgrounds. One is a former judge, I think, and one I knew one some years ago who had been involved in on the staff of a U.S. senator, and was appointed to the Maryland Parole Commission. But actually, I don't know a lot about these folks. I've been to parole hearings. I've seen how they operate. Walter's correct. There's always two, sometimes three, in the prison doing the initial hearing.
Just two.
Is it just two? And then they have to go, the recommendation has to go through the full board at some point.
Exactly.
And lifers don't get parole the first time they step up, do they?
Not at all. It takes years to go through that process. But in reference to how people get it is a political appointment. But everyone that serves on that commission has some extensive experience in the criminal justice area.
Okay, thank you, Arthur. So, Terry, is Terry still there? He just had that question about who makes up the parole commission. I don't have that information here handy on who all those folks are. If you want, we'll get back to you on that. Maggie in Baltimore, your comments on this. Hi.
Thank you. Peace and blessings to all of you. And you have a wonderful show. As a matter of fact, I heard Schindler early this morning, and I was so encouraged by the work that you're doing and what you had to report to the public. And I want to also give my respect over there to the hardest working delegate I know, Jill Carter. And I'm glad Walter Lomax is there to give us information from the experience that he's had. So with that, I want to say my voting last time was for those who have shown me that they care about our humanity. So my answer to this getting out of the politics of it all is we should demand that all our representatives, our officials, be given a course in human rights. They need to know what you human rights are all about, because as far as I'm concerned, too many of them are like little boys just playing war games in politics.
All right. Thank you, Maggie. Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, and I've written about cases of one of the inmates you mentioned earlier, former inmates, who went to prison as a juvenile and was in there until he was 42 years old and had been recommended for parole and couldn't get past Martin O'Malley. And prior to that, it was, you know, Paris Glendening. Robert Ehrlich was a Republican governor and actually commuted some sentences. He did not parole any lifers, right, Walter?
Correct.
Okay. And I remember talking to Paris Glendening a couple of years ago, the former governor, who thought he was wrong. Remember this story about he said life means life is wrong. It was a political move. He admitted to playing politics because he was concerned about his poll ratings at the time. He's going to run for reelection. No governor wants the threat of a Willie Horton type case coming back to bite him. So, yeah, that's where the politics is. Let's take another call. Rita in Annapolis. Go right ahead with your comments. Hi.
Hi. I think it's been kind of a disgrace that it's politics as usual in the state of Maryland. I mean, really, there are people, it costs the taxpayer $33,000, $35,000 a year per inmate. We have ridiculously high numbers of people incarcerated in this state. And a lot of the people that have got the life with the possibility of parole have served a lot of time. A lot of them were juveniles when they went in. They deserve a second chance. We would be better served in this state if we took that money, that $33,000, $35,000 a year per inmate, and put it in rehabilitation services. So these people would be ready to get out, would be ready to be released, and would be able to live in society without any threat to anybody else.
Thank you very much. Mark Schindler, to Rita's point about the cost, what exactly is the cost in Maryland?
Absolutely. So the cost
per inmate,
the report that we just published, we cited the cost is $37,000 a year per individual in the Department of Corrections. And that is adding up quite a lot in the state of Maryland. So the state of Maryland Department of Corrections spends nearly $1 billion a year now to incarcerate very significant numbers of people. And as we've been talking about, there's, I think, a significant part of that population who could be released and returned home with no significant threat to public safety. And we could start thinking about how we use those dollars differently, particularly communities here in Baltimore and around the state who are having challenges in a number of areas and resulting in people ending up in the justice system in the first place.
We should talk a little bit more about that after the next break. Before we go there, Walter Lomax from the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, your report, Still Blocking the Exit, on this very subject. Note here, the average age of lifers who were recommended for release but are still inside is 60 years old. All but two of these individuals are 50 years or older. And then you have your cost in your report per inmate cost a little higher,
$38,000,
but it's certainly up there, and it's grown in my time just in writing about this over the last 10 years. We'll take another break here and come back and talk some more. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join us with a comment about the parole process in Maryland, whether the governor should be removed from that process entirely. Also, Tessa Hill Aston from the president, who is the president of the Baltimore NAACP, is here to tell us about another issue affecting ex-offenders. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Walter Lomax has been joining us this hour, Executive Director of the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative. I mentioned the report they did called Still Blocking the Exit. They did it in conjunction with the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. And, Walter, this is good reading. A lot of good research in here about how the governor being involved in the parole process is a block to people who are recommended for parole, serving life with the possibility of parole and still can't get out. That has not happened since 1995. Still, that is still correct?
Correct.
Okay. And this report, we'll make it available through my Facebook page and on the WYPR website, okay?
Okay.
Still Blocking the Exit. I just want to take a moment here with Tessa Hill Aston of the NAACP of Baltimore. One other issue relating to ex-offenders. You know, a few years ago, there was a bill in Annapolis that was passed by the legislature allowing ex-felons to vote.
Yes.
Because in Maryland, up until then, if you had a felony conviction, you weren't allowed to ever vote again, right?
Right. Exactly.
So they passed a bill that said once you've finished your parole or probation, once you're done with that, you can start voting again.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
And so you want to go a step further with this.
Yeah, the NAACP was very much a part of that bill, and so we're very glad that that happened. And we register lots of ex-offenders who have completed that. The problem, while we've been doing that for the past years, every time we're somewhere and we're doing voter registration, a community, at a church, people will walk past and say, no, thank you. I don't want to do it because they're still confused about their rights. And we try to pull them over. We even have a big sign, ex-offenders who have completed probation and parole, you can vote. So register. So people come over. But what happens is some people are not sure, have I completed it? Did I really have to do that? They're not sure. So this new bill that Delegate Corey McCrae is putting in, that as soon as they walk out the door that they are eligible, and the probation parole has nothing to do with it because they've served their time, so they should be able to vote. And it's such an honor that when people get that card and they call us and we see them and they're so glad to have the card in their possession because they deserve it. So we're really pushing. There's a lot of groups of us that have been going to Annapolis last week to a couple of hearings, and the process will continue. So we're really fighting hard that people have their rights. And I'm just honored to work with people like Mr. Lomax and other people who got out, and I know some people personally that I've been affiliated with for the Unger decision, and now they're part of the process of helping and trying to help other young men. So it's a good thing. And so we're going to keep pushing for this bill, and I'm glad that people like Delegate Jill Carter, Senator Conway, and McCory, and other people are helping, but those are the ones that's really pushing for it.
You just want to keep it simple. If you're released, that means you can vote.
When you walk out, you should have all your rights.
Yeah.
They really should with anything.
Mark Schindler, Walter, do you have any insight on, well, this goes back a long ways, doesn't it? If you're convicted of a felony, this goes back to England and common law or something, I don't know, early criminal law. Some idea of punishment would deprive you of the right to take part in the society as a voter. Of course, you couldn't vote in England. But anyway, well, yeah, eventually they could. But this is a remnant, isn't it?
Well, it is a remnant in some ways. But what we see is it has very significant effects. And as is being said, one, it's not right and it's not fair. But we also know it's not productive, right? And so we know that when people feel more engaged to their community, like voting, they're less likely to commit crimes.
Yeah.
So it really,
if you get them that interested to vote, you know that they're engaged, right?
That's absolutely right.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Good luck with that, Tessa.
Thank you.
Tessa Hill Ashton, president of the Baltimore NAACP. So I want to go back to the subject, too, of parole in the time remaining and also the cost of keeping aging lifers in prison, or anyone, really. Mark, the one thing I wanted to ask you about in our time together was, does the Justice Policy Institute have some recommendations for what we could be doing with all that money we spend on inmates? Are there some inmates who don't need to be in prison as long as they are? Not killers, not rapists, but lesser offenses, people serving time for lesser offenses?
Well, there's no question. It's absolutely the case. There are lots of folks in Maryland's prisons now who don't pose a significant threat to public safety, and we're spending really significant amounts of money. And what the report that we just issued showed is that a disproportionate number of those people are from Baltimore City, but also other communities around the state are showing significant numbers, whether it's Hagerstown, who I think is second in the rate of incarceration. And the report that we just issued started to connect some issues. And right. And so the fact that Maryland is an outlier on this issue of parole and the governor's involvement is absolutely true. We should recognize that Maryland is actually at the forefront in the way that we now count people for representation purposes. So through a law that the legislature passed in 2010, Maryland became the first state in the country, to its credit, to change the way it counts people who are incarcerated, not where they are incarcerated, but rather where they are from. And so we now have data, and the report that we just produced shows exactly where people in Maryland's prisons are from to their block and their neighborhood. And what we saw is that very high numbers from here in Baltimore in particular communities. So we're spending in 25 communities in Baltimore over $5 million each for each community on incarcerating
people. In 25 communities in the city.
In 25 communities in the city. And in some communities, in 10 communities, we're spending over $10 million. And in one particular community, the Sandtown Winchester community, we're spending $17 million to incarcerate people.
Are we keeping people in prison longer? Is that what's going on?
We are. We're keeping people in prison longer, and we're criminalizing things that that are resulting in them being in prison for extended periods of time. And we're not getting a public safety benefit to it. We're not getting the bang.
So I was going to ask you that because, you know, you hear people say right away, well, society is safer today. It isn't as violent as it was 10 years ago, and we have a higher incarceration rate. So.
Right. And what we know is that in states where the incarceration rate has gone down significantly, crime is also down even more. So there's unquestioned research now that shows that there's not a real connection between incarceration and crime rates. Incarceration goes up, crime rates go up and down. But where the bill keeps going up, especially for Maryland taxpayers.
Dean in Baltimore, another one of our listeners, has a comment or a question. Go right ahead, Dean.
Hi, just a question for the panel. There's been a lot of talk about the cost towards taxpayers, and I just had a question about if prisons are entirely publicly funded and publicly owned, or if there are private big business type companies that are kind of driving the funding of prisons and have financial interests in keeping people in prison and creating more and more prisons that seem to have anything to do with the crisis of how many people are in prison in this country.
So we absolutely have seen that over years nationally, where we have private for-profit companies who are making extraordinary amounts of money on prisons. It's not so much the case here in Maryland, where the prisons are state-run, but there is a whole prison industrial complex. So the construction of prisons, the feeding of people who are in prisons, the medical care that's being provided. So we shouldn't kid ourselves that this is a huge money-making industry, and that plays out in Maryland as with other states.
Walter, I wanted to go back to Walter Lomax for a moment here on the numbers of lifers serving with the possibility of parole who can't get past the governor up until now. What number is that? Did you say we've approached 2,000?
Well, actually, there's over 2,600 people that are serving parole eligible life sentences, but 2,100 of them are actually serving the life sentences. The other half suspended sentences to a number of years, but they still have to go through that hurdle to
get parole
with the governor's requirement, the governor's signature.
The governor still has a say on that.
Yes,
but it's about 2,600.
Yes,
and the earlier number you gave us, the growth in that number, you said what?
When I went to prison in 1967. There was maybe a little over 300 people that were serving life sentences. And mind you, this was before life without parole. In fact, this is why they passed the life without parole way before the death penalty was abolished, to distinguish those people that they did never wanted to get out of prison, as opposed to those who they would have a realistic expectation to get out. But really quick, on Tessa's point, I was one of the first people that registered to vote when that law became effective in 2007. And I was very proud. I voted and campaigned for the mayor and president of the city council in Baltimore. I voted for the president of the United States. And it was a very, very proud moment. And so you're absolutely right. It does not make sense to have this this other hurdle there. Once an individual has served their sentence in a now few, because they're going to be paying taxes, they're going to be responsible for all the other aspects to live in society, and to restrict their ability to vote. And I want to just say how empowered I felt when I actually had my voter's card in my hand. It is a very empowering feeling when a person feels that they are actually a part of a community, that they can decide who their elected officials are, whether there's a speed bump or a stop sign or a playground in their community. That's very empowering.
That's right.
Okay. But, thank you. No, I'm glad you said all that.
That's very
Walter,
important. Thank you.
Thank you, Walter. Walter Lomax from the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative. Their report, Still Blocking the Exit, is worth reading. One last thing about it. I'm assuming, if this is true, that some of the parole-eligible lifers who have been turned down over these years have died in prison?
Yes, a significant number.
You found a significant number?
Yes, they are profiled in the report, specifically those who were recommended for medical release, and then others who have actually died in prison. But
We're about out of time. Okay. Was some recommended for medical release and not released?
Yes, they died in prison.
We get letters on that at the NWCP.
In 2011, we produced the documentary Blocking the Exit with Mark and them over at the Justice Policy Institute, and that has prompted us to do this Still Blocking the Exit, because it wasn't done in 2011, and we are saying that we're still blocking the exit. We should get it done in 2015.
Thank you very much again, Walter. Nice to have you with us. We'll also try to get a link to the report from the Justice Policy Institute on the cost of incarceration here in Maryland, specifically in Baltimore. Mark Schindler is the executive director of the JPI. Thank you for being with us in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And Tessa Hill Aston, nice to have you back with us, too.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
I want to say Aston Hill. I got Tessa. Hill Aston.
That happens all the time.
Nice to have you back on the show, too.
Thank you.
And good luck with your bill as well.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's the first hour of Midday. Open phone lines coming up after the news at 1 o'clock. We'll have Fraser Smith with us, Melissa Deckman from Washington College, Barry Raskovar, Political Maryland, all talking about the announcement this morning by Senator Barbara Mikulski that she'll not be seeking re-election. And open phone lines, so you can call in and comment on that after we take a break for lunch from Rossina Gourmet, provided every Monday for our guests here on Midday.